I'm going to start with a story. And then basically all I'm going to do is just say a little more what I get out of this and how I apply it and so forth. It's a story taken from a book on Mexican-American mythology. And when this story was written, it's all about men and the male god and all that sort of thing. So I'll try to, as I go along, change the language as I go. I may miss one or two because words come up in the middle of a sentence so fast that sometimes you have trouble making your translations. But it's an interesting story. It's a kind of myth. It's an old myth that was told by a very old woman some years ago out of Mayan mythology. Okay? I'll just read it. They were only four in number, the gods in heaven. Each one sat on a chair and rested. For the earth had already been made, just as we see it now, its lap heaped high with bounty. The ocean had also been already made, before which everyone who sees it trembles. The wind had already been made to be the guardian over all things, but people were not yet made. Then one of the four gods, the one dressed in yellow, it is characteristic of Mexican theology, if you will, or religious myth system, to put things in colors. And I think it has to do with the way people dress and the way they experience the sun and a lot of things probably that I don't even know about. But it's striking to me, you get a lot of colors. The gods are in colors. Okay, we've got four gods dressed in colors. One of the four gods, the one dressed in yellow, said, "We'll make people so that they may know us and their heart may be consumed with gratitude, like a grain of incense." The other three agreed with a nod and went to look for molds with which to work. "What shall we make people of?" they said. And the one who was dressed in yellow took a lump of mud and with fingers drew in the face and the arms and the legs. The other three watched and gave their consent. But when the little clay person was finished and was put to the test of water, it crumbled away. "So, let's make a person of wood," said the god dressed in red. The others agreed. So the one dressed in red lopped off a branch and with the blade of a knife marked the features in. When the wooden person was put to the test of water, and the limbs floated. They didn't fall to pieces, and the features were not rubbed out. The four gods were satisfied, but when the figure was put to the test of fire, it began to crackle and lose its shape. The four gods spent a whole night in parley, until one of them, the one who was dressed in black, said, "My advice is that we make a person of gold." And so that god untied the gold that was knotted in his handkerchief, and between the four of them, they made a model, this person of gold. One pulled out the nose, another stuck in the teeth, and another drew the snail shell of its ears. When the golden person was finished, they tested it in water and in fire, and the golden person came out even more beautiful and resplendent than before. Then the four gods looked at one another, satisfied, and they set the gold person on the ground, and they waited, hoping that he would recognize them and give them praise. But the gold person did not move, did not even blink, was quite silent. The gold person's heart was like stone, like very hard and dry. And three of the four lords asked the one who had not yet given an opinion, "What shall we make people of?" And this last one, who was dressed neither in yellow, nor in red, nor in black, for instead wore a garment of no color at all, said, "Let's make people out of flesh." And with his machete, he cut off the fingers of his left hand, and the fingers jumped into the air and fell into the midst of things and never suffered the tests of water and fire. Which is obviously a problem with this myth. I mean, if you lose clay to water and you lose wood to fire, how are you going to account for the fact that flesh is not going to withstand either one very well? I mean, all myth systems have their gaps, okay? So this one, the fingers leap through and skip the tests of water and fire. The four gods could scarcely make out what the people of flesh looked like because distance had shrunk them to the size of ants. The effort they made to see the people of flesh inflamed the four gods' eyes, and so with much rubbing of them, they grew drowsy. The one with the yellow robe yawned, and that yawn opened the mouths of the other three. And they fell asleep, for they were tired and old. In the meantime, on earth, the people of flesh scurried to and fro like ants. I just love this next sentence. It's just great. It just kind of tells you about the people who write this stuff. They had already learned which fruit is good to eat, with what big leaves they could protect themselves from the rain, and which animals don't bite. It's very basic stuff. Which fruit you can eat, how to cover yourself, and which animals don't bite. One day they were astonished. The people of flesh, the little fingers running around on the earth, were astonished to see standing in front of them the person of gold. The glitter struck them between the eyes. And when they touched the person of gold, their hands turned cold, as if they had touched a snake. It's a very old thing, isn't it? Snakes are cold. Anyhow, they stood there waiting for the person of gold to speak. The time came to eat, and the people of flesh gave the person of gold a morsel. The time came to go away, and the people of flesh carried the person of gold with them. And day by day, the hardness of the heart of the person of gold was softened, until the word of gratitude the four gods had placed within the person of gold rose to his lips. The gods woke up to hear their names pronounced among psalms of praise, and they looked to see what had happened on earth while they were sleeping, and they approved what they saw. And from that moment, they called the person of gold rich and the people of flesh poor. And they ordered things in such a way that the rich person should care for the poor and shelter them, since it was the rich person who benefited by the poor people's acts. And the gods so ordered it that the poor should answer for the rich before the face of truth. That is why our law says that no rich person can enter heaven if a poor person does not lead them by the hand. That's pretty, it's a little fanciful and so forth, but that's the bottom line there. The kind of moral bottom line there is, I think, pretty profound. Read that last part. And they ordered things in such a way that the rich person should care for the poor and shelter them, since it was the rich person who benefited by the poor people's acts. And when Studebaker closes, some people do well and some people do badly, and yet all were together in producing that automobile. The rich people live off the backs of the poor. And so the gods so ordered it that the poor should answer for the rich before the face of truth. That is why our law says that no rich person can enter heaven if a poor person does not lead them by the hand. That's a saying that could well be in the New Testament, that last line. I mean, it would not be surprising at all if a saying like that were found in the New Testament, but it runs very counter to what we want to believe in our churches and so forth. Okay, what do I get out of that? And not just out of that, the story kind of symbolizes some other things, that as I still get this stuff with or without the story, I'm not doing just exegesis of the story kind of summarizes some things that seem to me important. First of all, that if our lives are oriented toward gold, or things that are hard, or material things, that we develop a kind of hardness of heart. And words of praise and compassion and sharing do not rise to our lips. What the poor do, there's a passage in Haggai that I like a lot. Consider how you have fared. You have sown much and harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And the one who earns wages to put them into a bag with holes. Now, Haggai was talking about inflation, probably, local inflation. But I get this kind of image, you know, of we pour our lives into a bag, but it's a bag, our lives like sand, if you will, it's poured into a bag. But very often the bag has holes and things just keep running out the bottom. And so we never seem to be able to get the bag full. Our lives lack a sense of fullness. That's another way of imaging this. Insofar as we in American culture are turned toward material things, bigger banks, bigger churches, used to be the main symbol in town was the church on the hill, right? You go to some of the New England towns in New England, what's on the top of the hill? The church. What are the tall buildings in America today? What are the temples of American society there? The business of America is business. The temples of American society are corporations. Who owns the top of the hill? Used to be the church owned the top of the hill. Now it's whoever. I don't want to pick on any particular occupation because it doesn't lodge in any particular occupation. It can be whoever's got the most money is who owns the top of the hill. In the story, those who are of gold lack heart and voice and sharing with other people. The poor people, however, open the heart, give life to the person of gold. It is through the poor that we learn compassion. It is through the poor. I use the poor metaphorically here. Poor, oppressed, that would include maybe for many people, black in American society, Mexican American, some women in American society, some gay people in American society, people in third world countries. Poor here is used a kind of metaphor for those who are the outcast of a society, those who are the other, who are not like us, who are different than us. Let me give an example. I had a Guatemalan refugee lived in my home for a couple of years, and he had some friends in town, one of whom called herself Anna Maria. Never did learn her real name. In fact, the guy that lived in my home lived there for 2 years, never did know his real name. Couldn't tell you to this day. This woman was a Guatemalan in the United States in sanctuary. Before she left her country, the army came and took her 9 and 12-year-old daughters. Now you ask yourself what an army is going to do with girls 9 years and 12 years old, and you don't even want to think very long about what the answer to that question is. And her daughters have disappeared. She expects never to see them again. They are probably dead. Her brothers were active in what in this country would just be a labor union. We're not talking here about, you know, revolutionaries putting bombs under bridges. We're talking about people just helping organize other people for rights in the workplace. We're talking about education. The guy that lived in my home was a public school teacher, for goodness sakes. He just taught about democracy. and things like that. But that was not acceptable in his country. Anna Maria's brother was found under a bridge with his tongue cut off and his head laying beside the rest of his body. I reviewed a book a while back about the sanctuary movement, and there are stories in there about, like, a pregnant woman whose head is cut off, her belly is slashed open, the head is stuffed in where the fetus was, and the fetus is laid out on the ground where the head would have been. Okay, those kind of stories and contact with Pedro, we called him Pedro, who lived in my home, with Anna Maria, whatever her name is, opened my eyes to a bigger world. They made my world bigger. They opened up my compassion. They loosened my tears. They gave me the capacity for empathy in new directions. Connection with those people who suffered made my life larger and bigger and more humane. The people of flesh melted the heart of the person of gold, the person of gold. We tend to want to theorize about this stuff and theologize about it. There's a story, if I can find it here. It's here somewhere in these notes. Yeah, it's a dervish story. It's a sort of Indian. A dervish was sitting peacefully by a river when a passerby saw the bare back of the dervish's neck and yielded to the temptation to give it a resounding whack. Full of wonder at the sound his hand had made on the fleshly neck, but the dervish, smarting with pain, got up to hit the person back. "Wait a minute," said the aggressor. "You can hit me if you wish, but first answer this question. Was the sound of the whack produced by my hand or by the back of your neck?" Said the dervish, "Answer that yourself. My pain won't allow me to theorize. You can afford to do so because you don't feel what I feel." Well, when I am with people who are oppressed, people who are outcasts, people who are rejected, people who suffer, my eyes are opened and I become able to see dimensions of the world that I cannot others see or have access. Also helps to open our minds. When I taught in seminary, I used to have this course called Context, Community Context of Ministry. And students would come to seminary, and a lot of them had come from kind of small towns and did not have exactly what you'd think of as a global experience. And I would take those students and say, "You need to go down and you need to meet some black people." Or they would come in and say, "Oh, you know, homosexuality is all bad. My Bible tells me that it's bad, and my this and my that. And I read these stories in the Reader's Digest or something like that, you know." And I'd say, "Well, hey, I'm not going to tell you what you need to believe about this, because what you believe is what's in your heart. And you know, I can't say, you know, that you do. What I want you to do, however, is before you get your mind altogether made up, I want you to go over to the local Metropolitan Community Church, and I want you to worship with, and that's, as you may or may not know, it's a predominantly a gay and lesbian church, not exclusively, but predominantly. I want you to go over to a local Metropolitan Community Church, and I want you to meet some gay and lesbian people face to face. I want you to talk to them, and then make up your mind, you know, and whatever you want to believe, you're going to believe on the basis of whatever evidence. I want you to go to this black church. I want you to spend a night, you know, at the Union Gospel Mission. Tell me about poor people and how they're all bad and should be supporting themselves and this and that and the other thing. And yeah, sure, there are people taking advantage of our system. Of course there are. Go spend a night at the Union Gospel Mission and then come back and talk to me, okay? Expose yourself to the broader world. Expose yourself firsthand, not just through what other people say or what you've learned. Expose yourself to the broader world, you know, and see then how you read some of this stuff. And my experience was that minds and hearts were opened, and people became more whole, more humane, and more interested in justice. So in that sense, they were saved. They really were saved. in some sense, by the poor. Francisco Goya has an etching, which was the original subtitle of this session, but they figured nobody would be able to know what it meant anyhow, so we took it off. Si son de otro linaje. And it's an etching in his series, The Disasters of War, Desastros, my Spanish is not very good, I'm afraid, Desastros de los Guerra. And it shows this French aristocratic group. There's this guy in a top hat, you know, and spats and a cane, and he's very aristocratic. And here are these women, you know, with these formal coats, you know, and the buttons and the hats and with the plumes and all that kind of thing. And they're on one side of the picture, and over here on the other side of the picture are these poor people, and they're kind of lying on the ground, and they're in rags and tatters, and one is reaching out a hand like this, and they're all just nothing but skin and bones and skulls, and it looks like some of them are already dead over there. And what the rich people, the title of the picture, the etching is, Si son de otro linaje, they must be of another race, they must be of another breed, they are different from us. Even at a very simple level, I think a lot of people have body anxiety about people with handicaps, serious physical or mental handicaps. People stay away from people like that. They feel anxious, and you get this feeling, oh, they're fundamentally different than I am. And I think that's it happens in race, it happens in class, it happens in gender, happens in a whole bunch of different ways. And the way to get over all that stuff is to spend some serious time with people who are other than we are and see what it means. I also would say that doing this broadens our understanding of God and indeed saves us. What is the meaning of the word salvation? What I'm about to say probably nobody in the room is going to agree with, but that's okay. Diversity of opinion is a good thing, okay? It stimulates our thoughts. We can agree and disagree and still be friends and all that sort of thing, okay? Most of the salvation I grew up with was otherworldly. It was sort of imaginary. I was saved from being human. I mean, God saves me from being human. My sin was that I was human, that I was fallible, that I sinned. I mean, that's just what it means to be human. God had to forgive me for being who God made me. There's something, there to me was always kind of a problem in there somewhere. What is my sin? What is my sin? Over the years, I have come to feel that my sin, that into which I was born, I didn't start it, I just got there. But as long as I perpetuate it, it is my sin. My sin is the sin of racism. My sin is the sin of sexism. My sin is the sin of homophobia. My sin is the sin of overconsumption in a world of need. My sin is a class sin as well as a race sin. My sin is a sin of living as though there was no poverty in the world, of making, you know, an income in a world when... well, a lot of people, you know, in this world, annual income runs $150, $250 a year. When I think relatively, now, yeah, $250 is a lot of money, and if my water heater goes out, I complain a lot and all that kind of thing. But it's not that I can't marshal the resources and that I can't do it inside of a week or two or something like that, okay? Next payday. I may have to postpone something else, but I'm going to find the $250 or $500. Some people, it's their annual income. It's $250 a year. My sin is that I am oblivious to those things, okay? So the path to deliverance is shown to me by the poor. They show me that I overconsume. They show me that I am, people in black culture show me the racism, which is a disease of my soul. You know, conversations with women show me the disease of sexism, which, you know, I've been working on for 15 years, and it's still deeply embedded in my consciousness, still in there. I have immediate family who are gay and lesbian, And yet I still sometimes have to struggle with my homophobic feelings or images. You know, I have been near Anna Maria and Pedro and others. I had a guy, I wrote a short article once that appeared in the magazine of the Disciples of Christ, about this guy that I met him in South Bend, Indiana when I was visiting some friends. He's about 24. He had already done 5 years of time in the federal penitentiary. He's black, has a kind of, I don't know how pimp roll they describe it in books. When he walks, it's this kind of jive walk that's just kind of strange to me. And he somehow got the impression that if he'd come to Texas, where I lived, Fort Worth, that I'd kind of help him get going. And I didn't exactly promise to do that because I wasn't sure I wanted to deal with him, frankly. But nonetheless, all of a sudden at 3 a.m. one morning, I got this phone call. It said, "Hey, Dick, I'm here." So, like, who and where? I don't know who I is, and I don't know where here is. "Oh, hey, this is..." I'm not going to use his name because, I mean, well, you wouldn't know his name. I'm going to call him Fred. "Hey, this is Fred." "Okay, Fred, where are you?" "Hey, I'm at the bus station, man." So, okay. So I get down, you know, well, shoot, you know, this guy is tough. This is an urban tough who's done hard time. I mean, penitentiary time. This is not just, you know, the county jail here. This is a guy who has, I'll tell you what he has. So I get out of the bus station, I bring him home, and I say, well, and I'm nervous, okay, because basically I'm a wimp, okay? I mean, look at these arms. And I have, I'm divorced and I have custody of kids. I've got a 12-year-old daughter sleeping in the bedroom, you know, in her bedroom. And I'm a little nervous about this guy, you know. I mean, he's obviously kind of victimizer kind of person here. And if he decides in the middle of the night he's going to stab me and rape my daughter, he's probably can pull it off, you know. And I probably wouldn't be able to stop him, frankly. So I say to him, you know, well, hey, you can, you know, sleep on the couch tonight, at least tomorrow. He said, and he looked at the couch, and he said, nah, he says, how about I sleep on the floor? I said, well, you know, couch is more, no, I sleep on the floor. I came out late, came find out later that my sofa, which was at that point probably 14 years old and gray, it had originally been colors, but it by then was kind of gray. That he considered that too good to sleep on. Too good to sleep on. And I found out later that he had 8 brothers who had all shared a single room, an alcoholic father, 4 sisters who slept with his mother and dad in a 2-room place. One time, and he hung around there for a couple of years, and I'd see him off and on. I found him somewhere else to stay. I was nervous about him, frankly. I really wasn't wanting to take him in. And I wanted him to get out on his own. So, and I found him some work and had him do some work around the house and paid him and stuff. One time he got a letter. He used my home as a mailing address. And he got a letter. He's like astonished, you know. And he opens the letter. He says, God, this guy's 24, 25 years old by this time. Maybe 26. He says, it's from my mother. He said, I didn't know my mother could write. 25 years old and does not know his mother can write. I moved to Washington, D.C., and I sent out this form, you know, this Christmas letter, you know. I always debate, shall I send this form letter or nothing? You know. So I generally send the form letter. So, you know how you do at the end of a letter. You say, well, you know, come see me sometime. 5 days later, I get a collect call from South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Dick. Yeah, Craig. I'm sorry. That is his name. Anyhow. What's happening, man? He says, well, he says, you know, I want to come, you know, he says, but things have been kind of bad, you know, and lost my job, and I just can't come right now, he says, but hey, I'll make it, man. You know how it is. You know how it is. I'll make it. I say, all right. I say, okay, good.
Good. I mean, form letter? He doesn't know form letter. You know, he never got a form letter. He doesn't know what those Christmas letters are about. He doesn't get any meal, you know? He taught me that when you're in his position and you're in somebody, around somebody and they leave something laying around, you leave your briefcase out here in the hall, you know, and he walks by and he says, well, I guess they didn't need that, so I'll just take it. If they don't need it, I guess I need it, and I'll just take it. And it's not like a moral thing. There's no guilt there, because you didn't need it, or you wouldn't leave it laying around. This guy lives in a whole different world. And he opened up things to me that I couldn't learn anywhere else. I mean, I could learn from other people, but I could never in my white, middle-class kind of world, I could never learn that stuff. And so there's a sense in which I become motivated to respond to people like that, to Anna Maria and what's going on in Guatemala and El Salvador. Simon Ferrisani, some of you have heard T. Simon Ferrisani. Dean Ferrisani's been up here to Holden, been hanging out around the Pacific. When he first came to the States, he came to Fort Worth, and I did the local arrangements and so forth, and got a chance to hear him. And while I was concerned about South Africa, it was after I heard from him and how they, some of you may not know, he's a black South African pastor, Lutheran pastor. Dean of a Lutheran church in an area there. Guy, I guess, in his late 30s, maybe, something like that. And when I heard his story about how, you know, they took him to prison and they pick him up by arms and legs and they throw him up in the air and then they step back and they just let him fall on the ground. And I heard his story about how they put, you know, a wet bag over his head and apply electric shock and to other parts of his body and stuff like that. And how they'd hang him out of a window by his heels and then threaten to drop him and just let go. All he had to do was let go and he would fall this however, whatever distance it was to the ground. It is people like that who save me from the worst ravages of the accidents of where I happen to find myself in culture. Now, I didn't invent racism. I'm not doing a guilt trip here, okay? I'm really not doing a guilt trip. I didn't invent racism or slavery or sexism. I've never been to South Africa. I didn't invent wealth and poverty. I didn't single-handedly invent the destruction of the environment. But I kind of came in, and here they are, okay? And they're not only out there, they're in here. They're in my very soul. They corrode my soul. They make me less than human. They prevent me from working for justice. And I am saved to some extent. And then I, in being saved from some of these things, partially at least, I move forward and try to work for justice, and I become, I have the opportunity to help save other people. To save, I mean, I think salvation's been altogether too romanticized and mysticized. When Bill last night sits in here and talks, so this was a public thing, so it's not like it's a secret. We were talking about 12-step programs and stuff. Bill has been a drug abuser, and he's very open about that, so I'm not telling a secret out of some closet somewhere. When Bill is saved from drug abuse, he is really, honest to goodness, saved. That is, honest to goodness, salvation. If we were to stop polluting the earth, that would be, honest to goodness, hardcore, seeable, touchable, smellable, feelable, real salvation. Not just some la-di-da, maybe somewhere, someday, something. When the poor have enough, a story was in my Fort Worth newspaper some years ago on World Food Day, October, about the family that had a couple of kids and a horse. Peace Corps worker told this story back in Latin America. A couple of kids on a horse, and one of the kids got ill, and they had to decide whether to let the kid die or sell the horse to get the medicine. And they decided that they could always get another kid, but they couldn't get another horse.
And so they let the kid die. People face, that's unacceptable. That is unacceptable to me, that people are faced with those kind of realities on an everyday basis in our world. So that when we work for justice, when we love one another in very tangible ways, I really think that we bring honest-to-goodness salvation to one another and to the earth. I have other examples and other things I could read, but why don't we open it up and have some, let me see if there's just any short points I want to make. Oh, I think it also broadens our understanding of God. I think no matter what we do, God tends to be a mirror of ourselves. As I have myself. So what is God? Well, God's basically like me, except more powerful, more loving. You know, I just kind of amplify myself. And then I find out that other people aren't like me. And God gets more complex, and God gets more plural. I don't know if I should tell this story. I lucked into a summer Fulbright, was in Indonesia. And we were up in these highlands up there, kind of remote from cities. We were a whole day's drive north of Ujung Pandang. I almost bought a T-shirt that said, I love Ujung Pandang. Anyhow, and we caught a funeral, and these people up there, the Toraja people, and it was like in a open square, kind of outdoor kind of thing, and they had built these booths for a 2-3 day funeral, and all the family was there. Sometimes it takes them 2-3 years to get a funeral together because it's expensive and to get all the family back together. And they store the dead body. They put the body in a coffin and they store it upstairs until they can get around to the funeral. Or sometimes they bury it just a little bit and then bring it back up again for the funeral. But we got there and they were on the last day of a funeral. And there's a water buffalo tied to a tree over here. And there's a choir over here, and the preacher here, and then these people sitting in all these booths. And so the preacher stood up and preached. And I thought he was using the word Jesus. I thought, well, it's possible. There are Christian people in this area. But I wasn't sure. You know, it was in English, and I didn't understand their language, tribal language. And then the choir burst into Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, except not in English, but there was no mistaking what they were singing. And then as soon as the choir finished, Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, this young man took a big knife and cut the throat of the water buffalo. Say, well, Christianity takes a lot of different forms. And then they skinned the water buffalo and cut up chunks of meat, and people took chunks of meat home on sticks, and they put the horns on the front of their big three-story huts kind of things. Center post, and these water buffalo horns are on the center post of all this kind of stuff. Hey, the world's a lot bigger than I used to think it was when I grew up in Butler, Pennsylvania. And the more I understand of the world, the more I understand of God. So I think that that in that sense also, we are saved by the other, in that they help us to understand the richness and the complexity and the diversity of God. We want to make God one. I think God is many. So many, many that we can't begin to fathom what God is. And so through these kinds of contacts, that richness and diversity is opened up to us in people, as in a place like this it is opened up to us in nature. Well, I could say more, but let me shut up for a while. Give you a chance to comment. The risk of not entering into conversation is I'll go on. I'll read you another story or something. So, anybody have any experience they want to share or thoughts on what I've said or anything? Yeah.
I find it frustrating to be in a white community living next to an Indian reservation, where the non-Indian people see the Indian people as basically having chosen or made decisions to be poor, and therefore not being saved by, you know, the poverty of the Indians, but becoming judgmental about that. And And then in trying to open people up to that, people see me as a threat or
right.
as a, become angry
right.
At the one who tries to do that.
Right.
And sometimes people, you get an occasional person, say, Native American, who will talk to people, but sometimes they get tired. I've had people say, look, I'm tired of straightening you people. Go find someone else, you know? Yeah, that's right.
But it's those conversations, like you said, you send out your seminary students to meet somebody, and it's those conversations which become important, and those meetings of getting together over a potluck dinner or a feast or whatever and talking to each other. Well, that's very small-scale stuff. It's a beginning.
It is.
It's beginnings.
Yeah. It's hard. It's easy to disagree with a person about an idea. And that's what you're getting. You're getting disagreement about an idea. It's a lot harder for people to dismiss somebody when they're face to face with them and they tell them their story. And you say, God, you know, one person may be a far left and the other person may be far right, to use it on a political spectrum. But if they share how they got there and who they are and what they've been through and how they see it, it's just a you may still disagree. But it's a whole lot harder to stereotype that person as a, I don't know, what, a commie pinko or on the left, or what would far right be stereotyped as, whatever it is, hawks and doves, or in Vietnam terms, or whatever. It's hard. It is really hard to make those bridges. And I think that's part of the role of the church, to build bridges between alienated groups of people. I guess I think that at some level we all are all finally alienated even from each other, in the sense that we're never going to quite see the world from the same angle. You know, we have different histories, different experiences. But to rejoice in those commonalities that exist, it's really a wonderful thing. Yeah, I don't know how you... If people, I don't know that you can break through that very well. Almost need to have direct, personal... And the risk is that you have direct personal exposure and you get your stereotype reinforced. Because there are among poor people, people who could work, who aren't working, who are dependent on the welfare system and don't have to be. I mean, you know, there are people like that, or, you know. And so it's not that they're all... Yeah, but you just take that risk. You take that risk, and yeah, I don't know. I suppose it could be. I don't know that I've exactly read that anywhere, but I think it would at least be consonant with the message of liberation theology.
I've never quite understood what liberation theology is.
Basically, liberation theology comes out of Latin America. It's much more Christological than what I've just said. Basically, what you've got in Latin America are some groups of poor people who read their Bible and see that Jesus was poor, lived his life among outcasts, and they say, hey, we can identify with that. And then they look around, and maybe sometimes some elements of Marxism do play into it, and which Marx pointed out that the rich like to keep poor people poor, that the society does tend to break up into rich and poor, and that it's the advantage of the rich, at least in the short term, always to keep people, other people poor. They take money from them. They live off them. What's the word? Something that lives off something else.
Parasite,
yeah. And so they come very seriously. The liberation theology comes out of a very serious gospel center. And the stuff I've said was more kind of social analysis, interpersonal analysis. Very seriously out of the gospel center. And it says, hey, how come these people are rich and we're poor, and where is Jesus in all that? And they read their New Testament and say, well, hey, Jesus is on our side. So then there are various strategies. Some, you know, take to guerrilla warfare, and some just take to things like, you know, education. My friend Pedro, all he did was teach school. But they tend all then to become branded as communists and Marxists. But really the core of most of that stuff is a very fundamentalist reading of the gospel. It's not even liberal. I mean, in a kind of American sense, of a theological sense, it's really kind of a fundamentalist gospel. They just see that the Jesus they read about is the kind of person they can identify with.
I think, Dick, where it somehow breaks down what you've discussed this morning, as opposed to rich or poor or color or whatever we want to talk about it, we each are responsible for meeting God in Christ at the cross. And that's where salvation really comes in, is that relationship to God. And then whether I'm rich or poor or whoever I am, then that is the basis for my relationship and attitude toward other people. And I'm a little lost about,
yeah,
it's unbiblical in my way of thinking,
right,
how you describe salvation. It doesn't,
yeah,
make sense to me.
You're right. I'm going kind of an opposite way, and at least let me stimulate your thought a bit with it. When I look at people who go to the cross, I don't find that it necessarily has a transformative influence in their lives. When I go to church, I don't necessarily find less racism than I find in the culture generally. I don't necessarily find more willingness to work on justice.
But the flaw is, Dick, if you look at other people, you're always going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
And so each of us has the responsibility, I feel, to deal with that responsibility in light of what God says to us and how he speaks to us through Christ. Because if we look at, like I say, if we look at, put man, woman on a pedestal, we're always going to be disappointed because there is no,
right,
good in man, my own way of thinking, because we're fallible. And so you can look at good people or,
yeah,
bad people or good ideas or bad,
yeah,
ideas,
yeah,
and if you follow those and make that as your criteria, it's going to fall apart every time.
Yeah.
That's, for myself, that's true.
Yeah. I guess I would agree with most of that, except that I think God is fallible too. And I think that not only did Jesus die for my sins, but Mahatma Gandhi died for my sins. My sins are the sins of war and peace. Martin Luther King Jr. died for my sins, the sins of racism. The Buddhist monks who burned themselves alive in Vietnam to try to prevent war there died for my, what are my sins? See? And if I start saying there are things like racism and militarism and injustice, then who are the people who died for them? Lots of people. Lots of. It's a little different angle, and it may be that you can go from the angle I'm coming from and get back to what you're saying. I haven't made it that far yet. It is different. You're right. You've identified it correctly. There's a different coming to this from a very different angle.
Yeah. I think when we had some of the black, especially theologians, but the, other people too, lay persons, I think of Norm Howell, particularly, that was in India, was entirely different when he came back this last time. He came from Australia the first time. After he'd been in India and been with the suffering people, he came back and said, I'm going to do sessions on the upside down reading of the gospel. It's because we look at it from our point of view, never thinking about the third world people. And it was a complete reversal of, I mean, what we had not even looked at. And there's some books on it called The Upside Down Kingdom, I think.
Really? Who was this that did this?
This was Norm Hobble that came back with this.
Norm?
Norm Hobble.
Hobble, I don't know
former,
him.
Former Missouri.
Uh-huh. I don't know him.
I don't know what schools he, but he ended up in school in India and I think was not allowed to go back. So he's back in Australia. But it was real interesting to see the contrast of what he had been the first time. And then having experienced being with those people and seeing the gospel differently than what we look at made the whole thing sort of come alive. And I think we haven't looked at it. And Stendhal says the same thing about
Mr. Stendhal.
Jews and us Christians.
Yeah. That we read it the way we want it to say, not really understanding where the Jewish viewpoint is. And again, it's been all mixed up and wrong. If we hadn't had their record, we would have nothing.
Yeah.
We've got to look at that seriously. And they don't have to become us, but we need to embrace each other for what we have together. And I feel the same with the Blacks. I don't have to make them be a Lutheran, but I want to love you for who you are and let me be who I am. You know, when they've been here for 2 weeks and we have gospel singing, after 2 weeks, I said, now I've got to go back and have some Bach.
Right.
And you have
right.
the right to be you and I.
Right, right.
I'm here, but I think, right. that's not me, and I've got to let me be who I am too.
Sure.
And Elie Wiesel talked the same when I first heard him talk.
Yeah.
On our campus, and he said, please let us be who we are.
Yeah.
It made a whole difference in hearing him.
Yeah.
Just sort of pleading. We want everybody to be like us and understand the gospel. What are we doing? It's not right.
Yeah.
I think we've got to see it through their eyes, too.
Yeah, I'm bothered by kind of Christian imperialism. I've met Muslims, Jews, and Buddhists who are as serious about salvific acts as Christians. And some who aren't. I mean, yeah. Other comments from other people? Yeah.
I guess I'm sort of curious if you have any suggestions for how we can fight our stereotypic ideas. It's real easy if you live in a big city, which I do. You can go into many different ethnic groups, and I can meet them one-to-one. But what do we say to people who grow up in very white, small Midwestern communities? How can we introduce these ideas? How can we get them to
broaden their world,
that, you know, we are all part of the same journey.
Yeah.
One way.
Not sure I've got a good answer. Anybody help us here?
I guess all I could think of would be the AFS program tries to make an
That's a good idea.
Change. And I
if
remember
you can afford it.
In our school, we had
Is it expensive?
Every year it was Japan, Germany, places like that we got our students from. This year it was our turn to have the student, and they said, we want you to know that they're selecting, they sent us one from the third world, and you have the right to refuse. And I thought, well, it never occurred to me that I would even refuse any place in the world.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so our boy was an Arab Muslim from Morocco, and a very popular boy, very poor, came from a peasant home. He was made the homecoming king because he was so well liked, but it's one little step for doing it. And he said, you know, people are different here. He said, you go to the lunchroom and they say, I'm your friend, I'll save you a seat in the lunchroom. He says, that's not being a friend. When you're a friend, you know where they hurt. He says, so I've got all these friends that want to save me a seat in the lunchroom. He said, that's so shallow. He said, you people are so shallow. He said, I want to know what makes people tick. Here we were learning from this Arab of what the depth of human nature could become.
That's right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Can I tell you about one of the Native Americans through the nature walk?
Yeah.
And this was when they were here 2 years ago. And we got off to it. She was a medicine woman in the group. And really enjoyed walking with her. I was learning from her own. We got off to her and she said, you know, all these people here have glazed eyes. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, they're so busy running, they don't see anything. And she was talking about the bulletin board.
That's great. I need to write that one down.
She's so right. It was a good comment, and I told, told the Native Americans that were here, you know, her observation of us.
Huh.
We do. One thing I think is hopeful, I don't know if you know about Stanley Foundation, which is a Muscatine, Iowa, but they outreach in all the world, and lots of missionary support and schools and so forth. And they're originally from Iowa, and they have a task force going there. Every school in the whole state of Iowa has to teach global awareness from now on. And I think that's a big, great, big improvement that all is spreading everywhere. And I'm just so proud. You know, I was from Iowa, but not anymore, but I hear them when I go to, I tried to get the speaker to come here and his schedule was still there, but they did invite him. He travels all over the world too and has been in Russia many times. Understanding the people about the world. And they're starting this year in every state, every school has to teach global warming. And I think that'll be a beginning of understanding people, knowing more than about ourselves.
I think these are good suggestions. Simon Farisani coming through town, or sometimes even in small towns there's poverty, rural poverty. People that have worked all their lives and now history has kind of rolled over them. I mean, international trade suddenly rolls over them like a big steamroller. And it's not that they're bad people or that they haven't tried. You know, they've tried everything they could. But it's just that the forces that were operating on them were bigger than they could cope with. And maybe that too, I don't know. I think we're about out of time. My watch says it's time to quit. I'll be around yet another day, you know, if you want to just chat as we're coming and going. That I would be delighted. I if I can find time eventually, I want to get this all written out and have it in some form that could be read. So any, you know, ideas you might have, help me clean up my own act here. This is all first time through. I've never said any of this stuff before. It's all brand new to me. It may be dead wrong. So any dialogue I can have about it can only help me think about it and improve this so that, and maybe some other time it'll be in print or available to some other group and they will benefit from what you had to say as well as just what I came in with. So I thank you for your interest and we can continue talking. Okay?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.